Hello, and welcome to That's Not Spit, It's Condensation.
Hello, and welcome to That's Not Spit, It's Condensation. I'm Ryan Beach, and today I am very fortunate to be joined by Tony Prisk, the second trumpet player with the Philadelphia Orchestra, as well as being on faculty at Peabody and Temple University. I have known about you for a long time since you won the job in Philadelphia, and especially through COVID, you know, you were posting YouTube tutorials and things, especially related to orchestral music. And I was starting my own YouTube channel during then, so I was kind of looking around. So I've known about you for a while, but I don't know you very well personally. So I'm excited for this opportunity to kind of get to know you a little bit more on that sort of personal level. So before we dive in, I just want to say thank you for giving me some of your time and being willing to chat with me for a little bit.
Thanks, Brian. Thanks for having me. And kudos to you for all the great work you've done with your channel and your podcast. It's really great, great stuff. All of my students, check it out. And you're a gem in the trumpet community.
Well, I appreciate that.
And the wealth of information that's coming out of your content is really, really great.
Well, thank you for saying that. That's super kind of you.
Yeah, of course.
Sometimes you feel like you are posting into a void. I'm sure you know what that feeling.
I feel that. I can't tell you how many people, you know, come up to me and say, "Oh, I watched your videos and they were really helpful for this audition." And I'm like, "Oh, thank you so much. Do you subscribe to my channel?"
right.
I feel like I get thousands of people like saying that, but I don't have that many subscribers.
Right. Yeah. Well, we'll just keep trying. And
but we don't but anyway, do that, right?
Right. So to get started, I think it might be kind of nice for you just to, you can go back as far as you want, but because I don't know much about you as a person, it might be kind of nice to just root you in who you are and where you came from and a little bit about how you got to where you are now.
Yeah, sure. I'm from the Chicago suburbs, so I grew up in a pretty decent suburban music program, Glenbard East High School. The band directors and the beginning band directors in the program there were really good brass players, and set up a lot of really good brass playing in their schools. And luckily, I was part of that because I really didn't do much private lesson work when I was in high school. I had a few lessons here and there, and for about a year or so, I took privately with a middle school band director that studied with Ray Sasaki. But essentially, I loved the band program so much that I wanted to become a band director. So I went to the University of Illinois as a music ed major. And I did that for about 2 years, a year and a half, really. And then I switched to performance in my undergrad, thanks to Ray Sasaki. He showed me encouragement to play the trumpet. He's like, "You should try playing the trumpet. If it doesn't work, go back to being a band director like you wanted to be to begin with." So, I just was practicing so much, and I didn't even know what I wanted to do. I just wanted to play the trumpet. It wasn't like, "I want to be a principal trumpetist at Chicago Symphony." It wasn't that at all. It was just like, I want to be Doc Severinsen. You know, like, I want to stand in front of a band with the fancy clothes on and like, you know, but, now we have Jens Lindemann. So,
yeah, he took care of that for sure.
Love Jens, but Doc was like the thing, you know, Maynard Ferguson, that whole thing. When I was in high school, watching Harry Connick Jr. and stuff, and I just, you know, wanted to do that kind of thing. But then, I met some orchestral trumpet players, and especially Paul Markello, John Higstrom, and others. Scott Moore was one of them at the time. And I just like, wow, oh, that's music. This music's really cool. It's like, pretty in depth, interesting music. And, a French horn player at school gave me a stack of CDs of Schulte, Chicago, and all this kind of stuff. And I just, mm-hmm. Started diving deep into, orchestral music and taking orchestral trumpet lessons. And then I worked at Busch Gardens between my sophomore and junior year in Williamsburg, Virginia. And that was when my dad was like, okay, you can make money playing the trumpet. Cause I was like, I don't know, making $400-$500 a week or something like that, playing, 5 to 7 shows a day or something. And,
yeah.
And that was like, okay, I can make money. And I really like playing, trumpet all day, it was really cool. And then I met a bunch of people that studied Eastman and Juilliard and all these conservatories, and they were always practicing excerpts between shows. I'm like, what are those? bass trombone player, Greg Harper, he's like, playing all this stuff. And I'm like, damn, that sounds cool. So I started practicing some excerpts and took a lesson with Steve Hendrickson that summer. And then went back to the University of Illinois and won all the regional orchestra auditions and the school audition and stuff, and started just playing orchestral music ad nauseum. So it was like, I was still playing in the big band and in the symphonic band at school and stuff, but I was now I added an orchestra on top. So I was playing 6 to 8 hours a day sometimes, in school. And then I just kept going forward. It's like, I had the fear of not being able to make it. So that kept me very motivated to practice. There was something about, my dad, saying, you're not going to, make money playing the trumpet, that was always there. So I was like, I'm going to prove I'm wrong. But it was at the same time, I loved the music. So it was like, I loved practicing and it all kept working out. So, the little successes just kept me, motivated. And so I went from University of Illinois to studying with Paul Markello up in Montreal for my master's degree. There, I got a lot of opportunity to play first trumpet and do some gigs in town and stuff. And then from there, I got New World and was at New World for 4 years and studied with so many great trumpet players and got such a good perspective from so many different people. And then, luckily in my fourth year, I won the Houston Symphony position as trumpet.
Right.
They later became second trumpet. Went through some trials and tribulations with chops and with the way I played and stuff and dealing with, learning how to play in a big orchestra and with a lot more sound and tone. And then the grueling schedule of playing pops and classical weeks and pops and pops and pops and classical, just that all interspersed was a challenge and worked through a lot of stuff. And many different principal trumpet players came through there when I was there. I think I played with at least a dozen different principal trumpet players, Houston, when we had a search and when we were having people come in and do 1 year positions and stuff. But, after about 11 years, in Houston, I got the job here in Philadelphia. And this is my 11th season here.
Yeah, that's a really interesting story to me because it's somewhat non-traditional in that you didn't know right out of the gate that this is what you wanted to do and that you were pursuing an orchestral career. I feel like I decided relatively in college, but I was relatively serious before that too. And I'm sure you were, but I wonder if you have, going the music education route and then switching and then sort of deciding I want to be Doc Severinsen. And then it sort of just, it unfolded. I wonder if you just have any general thoughts about people who are in that position where maybe they feel like they don't have 100% of it figured out. They don't know exactly where they want to land. If you have any advice or some general thoughts about how to weather the spot in their life that they're in right now, where they're unsure, being someone who was in that spot, but now having seen your career unfold.
Yeah. I guess my advice to people in the same similar position, they just love playing, they love music, is just take every opportunity that comes your way. As far as getting the experience of playing different genres, and seeing what kind of speaks to you the most, immerse yourself in listening to a lot of different music, And then seeing what speaks to you, and your passion, what motivates you to go to the practice room and play? You know, I feel like if the only thing that motivates you to go to the practice room and play is like technical prowess or something like that, then it's like, you're kind of missing half the, or most of the picture.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Where it should be like, I really want to play this music, and this is what I'm going to, you know, figure out the path to get there. I think when I was at that age, I really didn't know that, that orchestral music suited me better, actually. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, kind of banging my head against the wall trying to learn bebop. And my brain didn't really work that way. I was more of a problem solver. So like for sitting in the practice room and working on excerpts and figuring out intonation and note lengths and volume and so on and so forth, that ended up appealing to me a way more than like, you know, working on this changes and like, and then working through this pattern in all 12 keys. And, you know, my brain just didn't like fire that fast that way. Whereas like, you know, most of the people that I knew that did that well were really good with math and like engineering and stuff.
Yeah.
that didn't really, for some reason, it didn't really appeal to me as much. I was much more of an ear kind of player. Like when I tried to learn jazz, it was all like, can I do it by listening and repeating and stuff. But whenever it came down to the mathematics of it, it was like,
that's so interesting. I never thought about, I mean, there's lots of differences between classical music and sort of jazz or commercial music. I never really thought about that being one of them as almost like a personality type.
Yeah.
Like totally. A more creative person may find themselves constrained. Like sometimes I feel that way in the orchestral world, right? Like we're constrained. Right. We have these styles we play in and there's sort of a way. You certainly have some freedom, but it's not nearly as much freedom as if you're literally making it up on the spot through improv.
Right.
And I never thought about it as personality types, I guess, like that. When do you, I mean, is that something you were aware of at the time, or is that you're sort of looking back and thinking about it?
I think I just discovered that by trying the orchestral practicing route and meeting the people that do that art form, and how they got there, it just appealed to me more. When I sat down to practice, I had much more guidance to my practice, that it was less, scatterbrained, I guess. I was a little bit more focused, and, cause I knew what the goal was. The goal was, okay, can I play pictures in exhibition in tune, in time, with the perfect, you know, articulation and note length and blah, 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 you know, or can I play it exactly like Phil Smith, or can I play it exactly like, you know, Bud Herseth, you know, trying to imitate those things. And I kind of got some of those skills from working on jazz transcriptions, you know, by like, can I play this inflection the same way Chet Baker does it in the solo, right, or whatever. And then I just kind of turned that part into playing excerpts. And then I didn't have to worry about what notes I was playing, cause they were written, cause they were all there in front of me.
Yeah. The one less thing to worry about.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't a bad improviser as far as like, at that level, but I just didn't, it wasn't catching on as fast. And I don't know, just the orchestral thing just all of a sudden appealed to my sensibilities a little bit more. And I saw a lot more progress a lot more quickly.
Sure.
So that for, you know, it could be the opposite for some students. I actually have a student right now at Temple that, the more we work on jazz, the better the classical playing is getting. So, you know, applying the same skills and the ear and stuff to both art forms is like actually helping that student a lot. So I feel like, it definitely helped me that I was involved in a lot of different things. And then I just gravitated towards another thing. I mean, to be completely honest, there was a time when I discovered that like orchestral musicians were tenured and got a salary, yeah, and benefits that really, right, appealed to me and my dad.
Sure.
So knowing that also gave me a little bit of like, okay, look, I can have a career in music that's not being a band director, that does have job security and does have, you know, a little bit of a, you know, a direction, as far as like my life in general could be better. I know that I won't be like piecing it together gig to gig.
Yeah.
So I, even though that's still part of it, but it's, you know, I just knew that that was an option. So, that appealed to me also.
That makes perfect sense. Obviously it's, well, there's a couple of thoughts I had. One was just a statement. I interviewed Whiff Rudd. I'm sure you're familiar with Whiff. Mm-hmm. And he spoke about improvisation and introducing it or incorporating it into lessons and into practice. Maybe not in the full blown, we're practicing everything in all 12 keys, but maybe in the, if I have pictures at an exhibition, let me improv something in that style to Absolutely. Get me a little bit more in that creative sound space. And then will slip into the actual notes that are written. And it's very similar to what you're talking about. It seems to help. It just seems to help everything feel more free. And so absolutely. Musically free. But I guess, so the question I had then is, does this manifest this sort of problem solving aspect of what you do? How does it manifest in your practicing like today? Are you a very structured, organized practicer? And because you like the clarity of goals, how does that manifest in your sort of your professional life now?
I think now I'm a lot more like what Whiff talked about, who I love, by the way. I love playing with Whiff.
He's amazing.
We did a lot of stuff in Houston together. He actually stayed at my house for a week of Mahler too. he's a really cool guy. But yes, I think a lot of the things that I do now when I'm working on the rep that I have to play for the orchestra is that I look at these licks and I decide, okay, what are the technical things I need to work on so that week is easy for me? And I'll just play scales and arpeggios and maybe flexibility exercises or things in the style of that music. Or just like Whiff said, I'm working on something like Pictures and Exhibition, I'm going to play scales with the same note length and articulation and sound and volume to just get really consistent with that style and have it really ingrained in my head. We just did Mahler 7 with Esteban and I kind of immersed myself into listening to him a little bit just to hear what kind of sound he makes. And it's so impressive. I can't even tell you what he can do. And I can't even say that I got even close to what he can do, but it's like, I just kind of like started, practicing things at home with his sound in mind, a little bit so that I was a little bit more prepared for the volume or for the brilliance that I was going to need to play with. And in my experience right now, it's a different principal trumpet player in the chair every week. So, yeah. This past week was, we had Aaron Schumann, and then the week before that was Esteban, and the week before that Jeff was playing principal. The week before that, I even forget at this point who was playing, but I'm playing with all these different players all the time, and I'm trying to find improvisations at home in scales, in Clark, in Arbenz, whatever, that help me to just change my concept a little bit, or at least broaden my concept a little bit just in case. Sure. 'Cause I don't know what I'm going to have to sit next to, or I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know how loud it's going to be. Sax came and played, John Williams concert with us, and I had no idea how loud it was going to be sitting next to him. I've only heard him live in the hall. I didn't know how hard it was going to be articulated what side of the beat he plays on or whatever. So, to make these quick adjustments. And so I try to practice a lot of that kind of stuff at home, trying to anticipate anything could happen.
Interesting.
So when I'm working on the music, I'll play it slow. I'll play it fast. I'll play it on top of the beat. I'll play it behind the beat. I'll play it shorter. I'll play it longer. I just try to like cover all the bases.
It's so interesting. I interviewed Ben Wright a while back and he speaks somewhat similarly to you, not the same exact way, but it's like the skill you have as a trumpet player and your production and intonation, so much of that skill is so developed. It's like you're now challenging your ability to do it in all these different contexts versus someone who's younger or students that you have. My guess, and I would love to hear what you have to say, but my guess is that you're trying to encourage them maybe with a little bit more, less outside the as regular outside the box playing a little bit more. We just need to get some consistency going. And then as they develop that, we start to add some improvisation or whatever you want to say. Is that somewhat accurate or do you see it differently?
Sure. I think you have to learn some of the standard exercises and things, to get you kind of a baseline, of your fundamental abilities, like doing Armin, the first few pages of the book, you know, and knowing how you're going to lay those bricks. Cause I feel like a lot of players don't realize that your notes need to be more like bricks, and then you can chisel away at those bricks and change the sound and change the shape a little bit if you need to. But if you can't lay a brick, then you're never going to, you know, lay down a good foundation for section playing. You know, like, you really have to be flexible. And if you take this solid brick and then you can chisel away, you can make it smaller, you can make it bigger, you can, or I guess you can add on to it, but you can, you know, change your sound from a baseline.
Yeah.
And that baseline needs to be in tune and centered and brilliant and all those good things. And then you can shape it to be darker. You can shape it to be, shorter, smaller, bigger, you know, and all the different dynamics. And you just got to keep expanding how big that brick is so that you have more to chisel away, that you can do more. You know, you can do more with that really solid sound.
Yeah, there's so, gosh. So it's funny. You and I spoke before the interview. I obviously have certain things I'm interested in, but it's like now I just want to go on a pedagogy tangent. But
yeah,
we can save that for a different one because there are things I really am really interested in hearing from you. One of them is about auditions, and I think it'll be especially relevant or exciting to hear from you because you've just been a part of a number of trumpet auditions recently with the Philadelphia Orchestra. You're welcome to kind of go over which ones you've seen, if you've been a part of. That matters to me, but less than just hearing from you, what types of generalities do you find that make someone a candidate for advancing, or what types of things make it so it's something you're less interested in? And, you know, can someone mess up and around and still advance? Is there a better time to mess? Like, is it, if you mess up in the beginning, is it hard to come back from that? But if you mess up at the end, just sort of generalities of things you've observed. I'll kind of just let it be open-ended to see where you go. But this is more for me. I feel like I've been struggling in auditions. I play well, but it's not maybe quite well enough or not what they're looking for. I'm not trying to overanalyze it, but I'm always looking for information from people who are knowledgeable.
Well, I can look at it from, you know, like several different positions. Like I took, I think 13 or 14 auditions before I won Houston. And then before I maybe six or seven more, because I was much more selective before I won Philly. So while I was in Houston, I took auditions that I wanted, took the job auditions, you know. And even in that experience, it taught me a little bit about, okay, I advanced in a lot of the auditions, but the reason why I didn't win them was a completely different reason. Mm. For me, it was that, you know, I lacked the either endurance or the confidence in my fundamentals to get through that final round where I could show a lot of confidence, to the committee. And it wasn't until, you know, like I got to Houston where it was like that list was so good for me, that I just felt confident I could play it no matter what they asked. And it was kind of the similar thing here in Philly. Like the list was so familiar to me that I just had to come and do what I do. Same thing in LA when I was finalist there for second trumpet. It was just right up my alley about what I was going to do. And for me, there was a time in my auditioning career where I thought I'm going to play principal trumpet somewhere, but you know, I was taking a lot of associate principal auditions cause that was what was open at the time, like San Francisco, Chicago, not Chicago. It was Philly when Jeff won. Mm-hmm. I was in the finals for that job. And then it was San Francisco. And then a couple other like little or principal auditions where I didn't really realize that maybe I'm not really set up for the whole principal thing. Like maybe it wasn't really what I should be auditioning for. And I didn't find that, that I guess niche until I got to Houston.
Okay.
And realized that list was really good for me. And then that job kind of, was good for my well-being or for the way that I approached playing.
Yeah.
But then now being on the other side and listening to a bunch of auditions, like when I was in Houston, I listened to probably like, well, we had, at least two rounds of principal trumpet auditions when I was there. When we hired Mark Hughes and Mark Inouye and all that. When I came here, we did a sublist audition, and then we've had, now two principal trumpet auditions going on a third, and then a fourth trumpet audition or utility audition. Sitting on this side of the screen, I'm hearing there's a few things that happen. I think that the committee has a little bit more open-mindedness towards the first couple rounds, especially the first round. We just want to hear somebody that plays with, you know, good fundamental sound, a good approach to the instrument, a confidence that they know how the repertoire goes. As far as like what you said about a good place to mess up, I think that it's okay to mess up as long as what you mess up is clearly just because you were either nervous or that, you know, that it was just a lapse of a concentration, and then you recover by like not doing the same thing again multiple times. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always good if you have a little bit of a fumble that, you know, you can play it better, to ask to play it again. You know, yeah. In audition, I always say, ask the proctor, just play it again. I made the mistake of not doing that one audition, and I'm pretty sure that's why I didn't advance in this one audition. Like, oh God, I could have played it so much better. And then I asked the proctor, should I play it again? And that was okay. I was like, I should have played it again. Most of the time committees will be happy to hear somebody, you know, put their best out there. And if you play it that second time, it's like, oh yeah, that's great. Move on to the next one. You know, that will happen a lot. So I wouldn't necessarily say a big mess up is going to like knock you out, especially if you like make up for it with something else great. I think that what gets the attention of the committee the most is somebody that can play all the fundamental things well, but then brings that extra like, wow, they had something to say, mm-hmm. You know? And as the later rounds go on, that's what we're looking for, right? So at the point you get to the finals, you know, everybody can play the trumpet well. It's not about that anymore. It's more about like, okay, well, does that sound fit into our section? Does that leadership quality, is it there? Like, especially for principal trumpet, like is what they're saying speaking to us? You know, I've heard a few auditions where it's like, okay, yeah, that's it. I want to go with that, you know? And if you hear those kind of auditions, that's where you're like, okay, you know, that's the person that's going to get the trial or advance or get the job, whatever. Cause it's really at that point, not about who can play all the notes, but it's about, you know, what are they saying? And, you know, like you said before, our art form is very, it has a lot of constraints as far as performance practice, what's on the page. And what's really great to see is when somebody brings something special and still does what's on the page.
Yeah.
You know, make some, you know, like spins a note in a certain way or articulate something so differently than you articulated the other excerpt that you can hear the difference between, let's say, Mahler and Ravel, you know, that it's not always the same, that there's a flexibility in the fundamentals of your playing that is, you know, shows through music making, you know?
Yeah.
To hear somebody play a completely different sound on Pictures and Exhibition from Pines of Rome, or you know what I mean, just to hear those that flexibility is like, okay, wow. I mean, it's inspirational. You want to sit next to that.
Yeah,
and it's very rare. And that's why, you know, with an orchestra like the Philadelphia Orchestra, we're a little bit picky right now, just because you've got you've got Nietzsche on a Rose playing principal trombone, and Matt Vaughn playing co-principal trombone. You have Jen Montone on our horn, and you have Carol Yonch playing tuba, and then you got me and Jeff in the trumpet section. You know, we've played with Dave Bilger, we've played with some really amazing players. We kind of have this sound in our head of what will work, and I think we're all on the same page, which is kind of cool. But, you know, it takes a little time to really, you know, fill a position like Dave Bilger has left, you know?
Yeah.
So there's that sound that we have in our ear. And then there's also like, okay, what else do we need? You know?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's tough. It's always hard to replace somebody that was loved, right?
Sure. Sure. Of course.
So that's the tough thing about sitting on this side, I guess.
Is there anything that's an automatic no? Like, if besides like bad time, bad pitch, I guess I'm just trying to think, like, is there something that somebody could do that they are unaware of, but that is sort of like, this is a no for me? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think a lot of times what happens, you know, we get a lot of great players that come play here. They don't know what their sound is like in the hall.
Mm.
So like at a distance. Because a lot of people don't record themselves like where a committee is sitting in a big hall. And a lot of people really overplay in a principal trumpet, like the principal trumpet audition. Like, I know there's a lot of great players that just played so loud that people on the committee that weren't trumpet players or like were more sensitive brass players thought, that sounds way too aggressive, because you're now standing at the front of the stage or sitting at the front of the stage playing your excerpts as loud as you play at the back of the stage without the rest of the orchestra there. Mm. And if people don't rein that in a little bit in an audition, it can be really aggressive sounding.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a little bit of an art form when you're auditioning, to not necessarily give all of that all the time, you know, to find those subtleties.
I think that's, if I were to guess, that would be one of the main reasons I've been struggling, is because in our hall, I've heard recordings, like we don't sit on risers. And so I have people in front of me. So I've kind of like learned how to articulate like fairly aggressively and, you know, spin the sound, whatever, to try to make it so I'm still clear out in the hall. And I, in my head, I like a fairly like on top principal trumpet sound. Right.
Yeah.
And like, but then I go to an audition and I play similarly to that. And I just, I that's a question that I've started to ask, is like, is that, could that be a reason? And then on top of that, like, so this, I didn't take it, but I was going to take the associate job in Philly, or sorry, in Pittsburgh. That just happened. And I think that was one of the goals, was to say, okay, for this one, I'm just going to temper the top dynamic and maybe pick a couple of spots that I might try to play the way I would play it in the orchestra. Does that sound like a better strategy than just playing it the way you would play it?
Absolutely. That would be a very smart approach.
Okay, cool.
I mean, one of the things somebody told me a long time ago about auditioning in general was that, you have your abilities, you know, this box of abilities, right? This, you know, box, if you will. And you always want to expand that. And in addition, you never want to play outside that box, because once you do that, there's a lot of, what ifs, and there's a lot of unknowns that could happen if you play outside of your box. You know, the sound gets bad, or like you play out of tune, or you lose control and you miss a bunch of notes. You know, it's like you can't play too fast. You can't play faster than you can play. You can't play it louder than you can play. You can't play it softer than you can play. You have to stay within your abilities. But in your practice room, you should be trying to expand those abilities as much as you can. But taking it, when you take an audition, that's not time to like, let's see if I could play this louder.
Sure.
So you kind of have to know even what it's like to play in a small room, and to make that the volume that you're going to play in a bigger room, and where that limit is, and how good your sound is, you know, at that limit.
Yeah.
You know, and never get to the point where the sound is like less than desirable. And it's subjective, but for the most part, when you get to that breaking point in the sound, everybody's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. It just gets offensive. And also it changes like the shape and the color. So, so like learning where that is in the practice room, I think is super important. And then when you're in, you know, getting used to playing in bigger halls and recording yourself in bigger halls to see also how that limit feels so that you get used to, never going there.
Yeah.
You know, and then some people don't have a limit and they just play as loud as they want, you know? So, it's just basically getting a sense for the room, I guess, quickly, like learning the room quickly.
For me, like, I'm not going to say I don't have a limit or anything like that, but I never feel when I'm playing at the loud end that I'm doing something I can't handle. But I can, even you just saying when you're sitting at the front of the stage, it's just like, I think just talking to you, literally talking to you, it's like sort of dawning on me that like, it's just like a completely different thing. Like you're not like, it's not like I should be trying to replicate what I'm doing in the on stage with the whole orchestra playing, you know, with, you know, 90 other people or whatever. It's like a totally different thing. And so me walking in there and saying, I'm just going to do what I do the way I normally do it, it's just like, it's almost like an illogical way to see it.
Yeah. You have to look at yourself a little bit more like a soloist when you do an audition. It's mm-hmm. like all the stuff that you do, how you shape the ends of notes, your articulation becomes very clear. It's like, you know, there's no padding. You know, it's like when you listen to somebody play in another room and you go, wow, that sounds great. And then you open the door and it's like, whoa, that sounds like great.
Yeah.
Well, it's kind of like that. Like when you're sitting with 100 people in front of you, there's some things that you do. And I'm guilty of it myself. Like, gosh, have you heard every note that I just played in that Mahler 7? There's a few notes that got away from me, like sound wise, you know, like, and you might notice it when there's 100 people playing, you might not, but for the most part, you don't hear all of those things. And in addition, you do.
Yeah.
So it just becomes a little bit more of refinement, in the audition process. And sometimes it just means taking a little edge off or taking a little bit of the, taking a little of the extremes off. You know, don't play too soft because you don't have to like worry about covering up a flute player when you're playing an audition.
Right.
And it's really subjective about how soft is too soft. Like, I mean, I can't tell you how many people came out and played Schumann 2 in the last few auditions that I've heard where you heard people play it like where I thought was a good like mezzo forte forte level, or some people that came out and played it so pianissimo you could barely hear it, which, you know, neither is good. You know what I mean? It's like one extreme or the other. There's a happy medium, and there's like a really good happy medium somewhere in that range between mezzo forte and pianissimo that people can play comfortably and still get away with it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's something to consider. Yeah.
Yeah. So one thought, so we're talking about, just to use the language, you know, you don't play quite as loud, you don't play quite as soft. You're a bit compressing the dynamic range for the sake of either comfort or for the sake of not, you know, being offensive. So I totally agree. And this is the direction I was sort of heading in with this previous audition, where the final conclusion I came to was, for maximum comfort, I wanted to try to see how could I just like approach the trumpet so everything, quote, felt the same. Like, I don't want it to feel weird when I'm playing loud or soft. And then basically then focusing on when I'm recording is getting certain like colors, right? So on Schumann 2, just getting a soft sound versus like trying to play soft, like, is that, I didn't take that audition, so I didn't get the result of my effort, but that makes sense to me. And it's not, I think as I have grown as a player, I've tried to expand my dynamic range and be able to play like quite powerfully in a way that's like, whoa, this is impressive or whatever. And then to try to really push the soft end, how securely can I play? And I'm just, like I said, even through this conversation, it's a little bit like I'm realizing some things about myself and my presentation, and your comments are validating too. So I guess for a question, does that approach sound reasonable to you? Just focusing on color, like not so much like get a good, healthy airflow and then focus on making the right color. Do you think that that would take care of many of these problems we're talking about?
Yeah, I do think that is the right approach. And then like we talked about, then yeah, you do want to work on the decibel level to be hotter and lower, depending on the repertoire. But like, But as long as you're coming at it from like, okay, to get the Schumann II color, doesn't mean I have to go like to this, you know, flugelhorn mouthpiece that has this diffuse sound that nobody will be able to sit on top of, you know what I mean? Second trumpet anyway. You know, first trumpet, like, is it going to be so diffuse that it doesn't sound like a trumpet sound anymore?
Yeah.
You know, which I heard a lot, you know, people like, you could clearly tell that people were playing like the softest mouthpiece they could play on. And then the sound was like a flugelhorn. So like, you know, I much rather would have heard somebody play like with a little bit louder tone with the same, you know, gesture, and more of a, you know, brilliant trumpet sound, rather than, you know, a high horn sound.
Sure.
So yeah, I think that's the right direction. As long as you know that, you know, decreasing that dynamic range doesn't mean you shouldn't be increasing your ability. That, and all I'm saying is that, you know, you can still play loud. If you can play really greatly loud with a good sound, and it never, you know, and you give the committee a sense of confidence that like, wow, this person can play as loud as we want them to play. Same thing with the soft playing. It's like, wow, that soft sound is so great. We know they can play softer.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, because they're so comfortable. You don't even have to ask.
It makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's just so much ease. So then, almost like focusing on ease is like kind of the top priority, because when you have limited amount of time, there's just going to be maybe an assumption. You're saying that they played loud with such ease, they can do louder. We don't have to ask. Yeah.
Right. I think that's what it just has to sound easy. Yeah. I mean, that's probably the key to winning an audition. It's like somebody hears you playing and is like, oh, yeah. That sounds easy for them.
Gosh, yeah. I feel like I could pick your brain all day about this, but we got to get to the thing that I'm most interested in. So even just to frame it for the podcast listeners, I have my YouTube channel and I've got like a playlist of trumpet fundamentals. There's articulation and flexibility and multiple tonguing and all those things. Mm-hmm. There is not a low playing video on there, even though I've wanted to make one for years. And it's not, I feel I have a fairly solid low register. I don't feel it's weak by any means, but I don't know if I have figured out how to talk about it, how to express it in a way where someone could understand what I'm saying. The same way I feel like I've figured out things like flexibility and articulation, whatever. So that's one of the big reasons I reached out to Tony, is I've just heard your videos and I've heard your low register and it's like, this is amazing. And so what I want to do here is to just kind of go a little bit into depth on low playing for me to be able to learn from you how to identify what issues may exist, how to go about solving them, and then hopefully for the people listening, they're able to maybe pull and glean some stuff about that. So I think the first thing I want to ask is, why do so many people struggle with the low register? It can be a thing. I have students where they can play to low C or low B, and then all of a sudden it's like everything changes completely. And no, I can't make a centered sound anymore and I can't find it or anything. Why do you think that's the case? What is so different about the low register?
I think because there's that gap between, you know, you got the fifth, you know, between the low C and the G, you've got that wider partial. And as soon as, you know, you have a student, you know, especially beginners, go from that middle G down to the low C, it's like, well, how do I get that low C out? Mm-hmm. You know, you open your mouth or you move your embouchure down and until the note comes out. And, you know, so everybody's like, oh, I got to open up. You know, everybody tells you, open up, you know, and I think that's the crux of the problem. It's like people are opening up too much for the low register, and then you get flat notes, you get dull notes, you have a very hard time articulating the note with any brilliance at all. And so that kind of is what I did even when I was playing a lot of first trumpet. You know, I was wanted to be Doc Severance. I wanted to be a lead player, you know, and I didn't really think about the low register that much. And so my low register was pretty weak when I got the New World, actually. I remember playing Carmen for Michael Dustin Thomas like 5 times because he's like, Tony, you can't play low. Like Michael Dustin Thomas told me, Tony, you can't play. You have to learn how to play low. and it was funny because then I got the job in Houston and I felt like I really couldn't play low either. Like I still wasn't there yet. Although I was getting better at it, I could play the trumpet all right, but it was like really didn't have a great concept of how to play low. And then it was like okay, now I need to learn. I really need to learn how to play low correctly because I'm really messing myself up doing it wrong. And it's really a sound concept. First of all, like, to not try to sound like a trombone player or a low horn player on the trumpet. It's got to be a trumpet sound in the low register with brilliance and core. And if you, like you said, if you open up too much and everything sounds tubby and weird, then you can't really use it. And so I guess what a lot of people do is they just drop their tongue so much, you know, they open up their oral cavity so much that, you know, the air slows and then you get a lower note, but there's no core and there's no control over the note because there's not that air compression. There's not the core of stability. And, once I kind of got that concept and I really got it from John Hagstrom, you know, like he really like showed me this is core in the low register. It's like, oh, you know, and hearing him do these exercises and things really got me to hear it myself and to feel it. And that's one of the things you have to first and foremost do is like hear somebody do it well, you know, and hear what that sounds like in the same room. And then to know what they're doing to do it. And I have a bunch of exercises that I've done over the years that really helps show people how that happens and how that works. A really good way to really work on this is to use stamp. Great pedal tones will also result in a really good low register and upper register. Mm. Yeah. So your tongue position is not that much different on a pedal tone or a high G or something, there's a very similar arch to the tongue. You know, that stays that way throughout the whole range, even though, you know, there is a slight adjustment in airspeed from opening up a little bit.
Yeah. It just seems like that would be counterintuitive, right? Nobody would think that it would be more similar from those extreme registers. I'm a believer as a teacher that sort of establishing some sort of basic baseline to get the right feeling or the right sound in like the most basic context is really important. So you can say, okay, I can do it on like one note and I know what it feels like and I know what I did. I can begin to take that into other parts of the register. Is there anything like that you can recommend to as like a starting point? So you have a student or a player who just cannot play like a low G to save their life. What process would you go through to get them to be able to play just like a low G, or maybe it's not a low G, maybe it's a low C, but what would you recommend to that person to be able to get them to feel and hear, in addition to you playing or in addition to somebody great playing, how would you get them to do that?
Well, there's several things. My first go-to is always to be, you know, start working with the chromatic scale and see where things start to change for the worse. You know, like as we go down from our greatest note, like if we find a really good, comfortable, like balance and brilliance on, let's say, middle G. And then as we go down, listen for when that brilliance goes away. You know, what did you change? You know, was it on the low C? Was it just that one partial? Or was it actually on the E on the way down? Or was it did you start opening up too soon? That's one thing. The other thing is lip slurs. Like doing a lip slur exercise. I don't know if you want me to demonstrate with a horn, but
I'll take whatever you can give me.
take this off.
Audio listeners, he's just going to take his headphones off and he's going to start demonstrating and playing video on YouTube. You'll be able to see what's going on.
Yeah. One of the biggest concepts that I want to drive home is that when you have that balance correct on one note, I want you to bend from that one partial to the next partial. And I want that bend to be as loud as the note you were playing. And I want that bend to stay as loud as the note you were playing until the next note pops out. And I call those the pops, like when I'm doing lip slurs. And I think that's what Scott Bell calls it too. Mm-hmm. But finding your note,
I
So the note just really pops out. I don't know how that sounds on your end.
It's great.
But the note pops out, and that's where the horn wants the note to slot. So you really hear that brilliance from the one note. See how that just popped out, and it's a really like resonant tone. Mm-hmm. You go down to the low notes, it's a little harder because it's a longer way to go, but you do the same thing. So you're letting the horn show you where that note is, and you don't open up any more than you have to, then to get that note out.
And it requires what it looks like and what it sounds like is it requires your air to be able to play those notes. That bend is loud, is your air to be forward and energized and excited and everything, so that you're learning like what that feels like to not open up, but to stay focused.
Absolutely. So you have that constant air pressure against the opening of your oral cavity very slowly, like I'm very little, like yeah. I'm opening up so slowly that the pitch is changing that slowly, but you hear the volume, which actually means I have to like put a little bit more air pressure against the change. And then when that note pops out, you hear how brilliant the pop is. And that's a low register that you can use.
Yeah.
You know, where the sound is brilliant and centered, because if I go past it, and this is what a lot of people do when they do this exercise to begin with, they don't do the bend as loud as the note they're coming from, and they go beyond where the note pops out, something like this. You know?
Yeah, down into where you opened up.
And they sneak out, they sneak the note out, and it's flat, and it's not as brilliant. Because you're tasting where you think the note goes and not where the horn wants it to be.
Yeah.
So learn where the horn wants it. And it's going to be different on every instrument and every mouthpiece. But you know, so you can actually feel that. And then I can do like low register shakes because of that, you know.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm letting the horn show me where the notes go, and I'm just putting air at it.
Yeah.
You know, so if I go, you know, like
it's gonna make a good introduction to the YouTube video.
Yeah. You know.
Yeah. So then, that actually, I like that a lot. Would it be difficult? It would be difficult to do that exercise down on the low partials because you don't have an open partial below it, right? So like if you started on low C and tried to bend down to wherever that note would, you wouldn't have an open note below it. So how would you?
No, you definitely want to do these within the partials of the instrument, okay. You know, like this exercise. Because if I just do from like low C to like pedal C or something, you know, like yeah. I can do that, but the pedal, my open pedals aren't that great.
So then is the exercise just teaching you what it feels like to stay focused and forward and energized and everything rather than opening up, and then you apply that to the low register? Or
no, you're actually, I mean, well, yes, but you're actually learning where the low note actually is on the horn. Yeah. As opposed to like thinking you know,
because you can just do, you can just do D flat to C, G flat. I didn't even think like you're already in that register. Like, what am I thinking about? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm already down there. Right. Because that sound, see, when you heard me play, it sounds higher, right?
Yeah, I got confused for a second. I was like, sorry. Yeah,
exactly. So I'm already playing the lowest notes on the horn, except now you could definitely take it into the pedal register. I think that when I go down, yeah.
So yeah. I mean,
yeah. So I'm getting there. So now I just want to learn where that pop happens and retain that kind of feeling of. So when I start adding the tongue, the air is already there.
Yeah.
And the center is already there.
At a separate time, we need to talk about articulation also, because I love the way your articulation sounds. But that'll be another thing. We're talking about low plane right now. Two other questions I have, and you've sort of covered them, but just for the sake of making sure it's clear, the first one is, how will, so like when they get that pop, is that how someone knows that it, like, how does someone know that they've gone too far? Like you described that exercise when they're doing it on their own, they don't have someone, if they're trying to do this on their own, how do they know that they've got the pop and it's in the right place versus they've gone too far?
If the note sneaks out, if the note comes out, mwah, you know, that's usually a sign that you lipped it too much. You didn't keep the air moving and you grabbed the airstream too much. You didn't just let the note fall into place. One of the things you have to do, especially the lower ones, because it is harder as you go down more fingerings, the longer the horn is, the harder this is. You know, the harder it is to feel, mm-hmm. Because you really have to move more air through the tubing. You know, or you have to feel, you have to excite more tubing is essentially. So, and it's way more out of tune. So, by the way, we're not thinking about intonation right now at all.
Right.
We're thinking only about getting the brilliance and pops. We will fix the intonation once we get that. We got to get that first though. If we don't play a centered sound, then we're just polishing a turd.
You know, like, yeah. Completely agree.
Yeah. So what I want, and I'm not so concerned about it. Although if you put this on a tuner, I've got a tuner sitting right here. Where that note pops out, it's going to be actually a little sharp because low C's are sharp. You know, that's all there is to it. And I'm going to then adjust it once it pops out. It's really easy for me to move it into the right place.
Yeah.
Once the note's centered.
Because you have that healthy stream of air that's powering it.
Yeah. And it's balanced.
Yeah.
You know, you're not fighting the horn in the center of the instrument. Huh. If you only play these exercises with a great ear to intonation, then you are going to manipulate the centers. You know, it's just like what we have to do on a D. You know, it's obviously going to be flat if you center that note. So what I'm thinking is like, okay, I know that note centers, you know, flat. And that's the best sound that I can make on that note. But now I know that where that center is, I can adjust quickly to the actual in tune note. Right.
Yeah. So you don't even notice it.
Yeah. So that I'm adjusting from center. And if you don't know where your center is on your instrument, then intonation will also be a problem, especially when you're playing with people with bad intonation, because you'll adjust to people from not from center. And then you're really talking about getting out of your good sound.
Yeah.
You know, we've all had this experience of playing in a section with people in a really out of tune section. And if you're not, if you're trying to tune to those people without a centered sound, you get much more tired, and when you finish playing, you can't find your notes anymore.
Yeah.
Especially if you're playing second trumpet and you're playing low and you're not centered, you get that low lock that a lot of people talk about. You know, like when you're playing second trumpet on a Beethoven symphony, and the whole time you've been matching somebody that's playing maybe a little bit sharp or something. If you're playing on the high of center for the whole symphony, of course, when you go to play, but without, you know, when the concert's over, you go to play and nothing works. You know, I was guilty of that in Houston. Like I was playing wrong in the low register. I was trying to tune not from my center, but just using my ear. And thus I was never playing to my most ideal sound.
Yeah.
But if we always adjust from our most ideal balanced sound on the instrument, we'll be way more efficient and be able to play longer. And you'll be surprised after playing a bunch of low stuff, you can still play high.
This is This is fascinating. I'm so grateful that you agreed to do this. The last question I have is, I have them written down here. I wanted to make sure I didn't forget it. Oh, so like, obviously we're talking right now. This is like a very basic exercise, right? Like, yeah. It's just to figure out where do these notes go. For you, is there like a metric you can think of that would sort of indicate to someone that they've got a usable low register? Like, obviously, because what you talked about, you felt like you had progress to make in Houston, but you're in the Houston Symphony. It's not like it's all or nothing. So obviously there's a spectrum in there in which you can be successful but not have everything figured out. So where do you feel like the line is where it's like, okay, I can start to use this even if I have progress to make? The only reason I ask this is just to help people who are still in the process of getting better have some sort of metric checkmark, small goal like you talked about at the beginning of like, okay, I'm on the right track. Things are getting better. Things are working. I should just keep doing what I'm doing.
That's tough because you have your long term goals and your short term goals, and or if you look at least long term landmarks, if you will. I don't know, because you don't ever want to, like, I don't know, if you look at like the James Clear thing, like you don't want to have a clear goal, because then you never shoot above that goal. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to like know that, like, okay, look, I'm doing this exercise correctly and I'm getting it, but I'm not getting in that every time I play yet. You know, like in context of music. It'll come the more you incorporate it into your daily fundamental practice, you know, and I think that's really important for me and for my students. It's like making sure that they know that a daily fundamental routine can show a lot more results, because you're doing these exercises that you know that are weaknesses, or that things that get you more centered, or help you find a better tone or play more in tune on a daily basis. And you can kind of see that progress. And sometimes you don't even see the progress, because people just start hearing the progress and saying, hey, you know, that sounds great. Like, what have you been doing? You know?
Yeah.
So incorporating something like this exercise into your daily fundamentals, like when I do stamp, you know, when I was doing sax daily fundamentals, and when I was in Houston, when I was trying to learn how to play low in a better way, I just incorporated these exercises into my daily fundamentals. And then it just became part of my playing when I was working in excerpts and when I was working on solos and I was working on the pieces that I was playing in the orchestra. Every time I put the horn on my face, I was trying to incorporate these things. So it was more of like, it just kind of like osmosis kind of like grew into my playing, and it was just there, you know?
Cool.
So I would say, you know, you can know that you have these issues in your playing, but like, you don't know how, you might not know how it's like, become a real part of your playing and a part of your like DNA until you like go to play that excerpt that you played a long time ago that you thought was hard. And now it's not hard anymore.
Yeah.
You know, you go to play, Carmen and all the notes just feel easy and ringing, you know, or you go to play Dvorak 8, you know, and the notes are just there, you know. I guess it's just knowing that you're on the right path is probably the best mentality to have.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. No, I think that's something it's important to me to be able to help students with that, or people who are like, you're on the right track, keep doing what you're doing. Like, it may not be exactly what you want, but it doesn't mean that what you're doing is wrong. Cause I think sometimes if we're not there, we think, oh, I got to change all this stuff up if it's not exactly what I want, or am I doing it right? And so having some sort of assurance that if you're hitting some of these benchmarks most of the time in basic ways, you're probably on the right track and you just need to keep at it. I know you have a zoo date with Ella, so I'm going to, we could stop it here. And then I would love to do this again sometime and just keep the conversation going. But I want to thank you again for your time today. And if somebody wants to reach out and talk to you about some of the low playing or auditions, or just in general, say they enjoyed this episode, how would someone get a hold of you?
A few different ways. You can check me out on the Philly OTPT2 on YouTube or on Instagram and just message me there. If you see one of my videos, you can comment on one of my videos and happy to like respond to you. And you can also reach me through Peabody and Temple. Those you can get my emails from those websites. You know, private message me or whatever, and I'm happy to like, you know, answer questions and or get together for online or in-person lesson.
Yeah. So if that's interesting to you, go ahead and take advantage of that. Quickly, I want to thank Brandon Yoakum for his work on mastering this episode of the podcast. You can check out Brandon at epiphanyrecordingstudio.com. And most of all, I would like to thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the episode. We'll see you in the next one.